Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Let's talk now local sports news coverage. It's key to how we understand our neighborhoods, our communities, our sense of camaraderie. It is also falling victim to the same financial pressures as other kinds of local news. So the New York Times, for example, sent a shockwave through the sports media world recently when it closed its local sports desk. So let's look at the implications of those kinds of things. Shalise Manza-Young is a columnist for Yahoo Sports, and A. Sherrod Blakely is an NBA writer and lecturer at Boston University's School of Communications. Shalise, welcome back.
Thank you.
Sherrod, thanks for coming.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So let me just flesh this out for listeners a little bit more. Earlier in July, New York Times says they're going to close their sports desk. They're going to move their sports reporters to other news desks. They're not getting fired, but they're going to go to, you know, business or Metro and kind of bring angles to those news desks. And the New York Times is going to use The Athletic for core sports coverage. Shalise, just reactions when you heard that.
My initial reaction was a phrase that I probably shouldn't say.
Yeah, we're public radio.
Yes.
Okay, but it gives us a sense of your...
It was stunning. It really was stunning. I mean, the New York Times, as we all know, it's such a well-established, old paper. They've done sports coverage and done sports coverage well in New York, in the United States, around the world for decades. And for them to get rid of that sports desk, you know, Sherrod and I'm sure, you know, Bill Roden, an icon of this business, particularly for young Black journalists, he was at the New York Times. We can point to so many amazing sports writers over the years and stories that they uncovered. And it's just in one fell swoop gone. And beyond that, they don't want to cover the games as much anymore, even at The Athletic. And what do we have if, you know, the games are the foundation for everything else? You know, I love telling stories. I love writing about people, but what they do on the courts, on the fields, in the pools, that's why we are drawn to tell their stories. So it was just stunning.
So Sherrod, I'm going to set this up a little bit. This is a serious issue. I'm going to be playful just momentarily because I can imagine our listeners saying, I don't care what happens in New York, right? I'm from Boston. I especially don't care what happens in New York. But there are a lot of implications here. So we had Boston Globe reporter Alex Speer on with us the day after to talk Red Sox, talk something else. But we took a second after the show to ask him about his reaction to the news. Here he is.
It is concerning for those of us who work in the industry of sports journalism about what the future of that industry is. And it leaves you kind of scratching your head a bit about what is the interest intrinsically in sports journalism in the written word. That's something that a lot of us are trying to make sense of right now.
So, you know, the New York Times, a big paper, but this is happening and has been happening a lot of places. You know, I think Shalise started to get at this intrinsicness, but in a local community, talk about the intrinsicness of sports and reporting sports and telling us our stories about each other as we watch our sports.
Well, the one thing that this industry isn't all that different than any other industry, and that is it's a copycat league. And if the New York Times decision to disband its sports department, let's say the Boston Globe preventing them from doing the same and just going to go with a more nationalistic approach to covering news. The one thing that I thought we learned in the pandemic was the value of live coverage, because during the pandemic, we could not send as many people to cover events because of just the concerns about the pandemic and such. And yet here, this is a clear 180 from that, because now they're doubling down on just being a storyteller. But what are you going to be telling stories about if you're not there capturing the actual events? This is a trend that started, you know, a couple decades ago, where newsrooms began to pull back from their road coverage and instead cover games here and there, as opposed to covering day in, day out. And what happens every single year is something happens on the road, their reporter is not there, and then they're scrambling to tell the second day story because they don't have the ability to sit to talk about what happens in that moment. And it saves them money, which is great. But are you doing a disservice in the process to your readers? Are you not providing them that instantaneous in the moment coverage that they're paying for?
So, Shalise, bring that alive for us, what Sharad was just saying, with an example from a Boston sports team. Something happened on the road sometime in the last couple of years, and maybe one of the local news organizations didn't have someone, now has to scramble and do their day two coverage instead. What's an example of that?
You know, I've, because my job is more national, funny enough, the last few years,
or give us any example.
You know, I think any game, you know, if you're a Patriots, you know, an outlet that covers the Patriots, you know, we remember that disastrous game they had in Las Vegas. If your reporter isn't there, then you don't get to be in the locker room immediately after it happened to get the raw emotional reaction. You either have to rely on emailed transcripts, and that's up to the team, what they send you, or the next time you have access, and by then, you know, Bill Belichick or whomever has gotten them to be like, nope, we're not talking about this anymore.
Right. So, okay, right there, right? Especially because I tell you, everyone knows that if Bill Belichick gets a chance to say, we're not saying anything about that, right? Just like that. We know that's what he's going to do in this case.
That was pretty good.
Thank you. Jacoby Myers laterals. Chandler Jones recovers it. There's a walk-off touchdown. And I appreciate, you know, I'm sorry I put you on the spot on that, but I want to bring it home because those are those moments, right? Because we, Sharad, our teams are us. You know, it strikes me that we became, using an example, Red Sox Nation, right? That was a sense of identity and membership. And what happens on the field solidifies that sense of identity and membership. And what I wasn't understanding, I think, even in preparing for this conversation, until you both said it, was that comes down to what happens in the game.
Right.
And that's what sports journalism brings us.
Well, that ultimately determines the stories you tell. Your stories are based upon the engagements and the interactions that you have with these athletes and your ability to tell those stories to a mass audience. It's a bit of a head scratcher, to be candid with you, to see some of the decisions that are made that seem to be more about what benefits the folks that count the beans as opposed to the folks who actually drink the coffee that the beans are made from. And I just think that, you know, the other thing that with the New York Times kind of bringing it back full circle that comes to mind is when they made the decision to move people out of the sports department and just move them into these other areas, which fits in great for us who teach because we can talk about having lots of tools in your toolbox of talents because this is an example of when that can come in handy. But for me, the bigger issue is I think this is just one of the many shoes that's going to drop. And what I'm not clear on is when they have their next round of cutbacks, are you going to keep the people that you moved out of the sports department intact, or are you going to cut away at the Athletic that's your new sports department? Which of those two groups is going to be impacted going forward? Because one of them will be. I mean, it's not a matter of if it's happened, but when it's going to happen.
One of the interesting things is, you know, people who are at the New York Times, one of the things that they pointed to is the writers at the Athletic are not unionized the way that many of the writers in the New York Times newsroom are. So in doing this, you know, as we talk about cutbacks, it becomes much easier in the future to cut Athletic, you know, editors, reporters, whomever, because they're not unionized. They have no protection as of right now. Could that change in the near future? Possibly. But as of right now, they have no union protection.
So I want to point two things out there, and I'm glad you brought this up. And by the way, we're speaking with Shalise Manza-Young, who's a columnist for Yahoo Sports, and A. Sharad Blakely-Sharad, who's an NBA writer and lecturer at Boston University School of Communications. We're looking at this consolidation and collapsing of sports journalism and what it can mean in a community, right? Mm-hmm. So I want to come back to this idea because first I want listeners to understand, Sharad, that the New York Times owns The Athletic, Mm-hmm. Right. So what Shalice is saying about they've got union employees in their reporters and in The Athletic, they have non-unionized employees and they own that. The second thing is I want to come back to 2017. So one of The Athletic's founders, Alex Mather, told The New York Times then that the company's business model was essentially to break local sports in newspapers. So this was a quote from an article in the Times then, quote, "We will wait every local paper out and let them continuously bleed until we are the last one standing. Mm-hmm. We will suck them dry of their best talent at every moment. We will make business extremely difficult for them," end quote. Mm-hmm. Now, in the moment of irony, I want to note that we regularly use an athletics journalist here, Fluto Shinzawa, who we love, who covers the Bruins, and who used to be at the Boston Globe before until 2018. So we're watching this happen. You're the one that says, hey, we could see it happen here. Yeah. I should probably also note that the people who own the Red Sox own the Boston Globe.
Exactly.
So then what happens to other kinds of sports, like local, like high school sports and young stars who are coming up, like the basketball player out of Brockton, the high school freshman who has a great shot already, it looks like, at the NBA? Who covers that stuff? And what do we lose when we don't know?
And that's one of the issues that happens when you have these created news deserts where there just isn't any type of local on-the-ground coverage. He did walk that back a little bit after he said it, but here's the thing. No one fully believed him when he tried to walk it back because
he said it.
Because he said it, right. And I truly believe he feels that way. And when you look at the way that they've gone about putting their group together, he didn't lie. I mean, when you look at his roster, you look at the talent that they've been able to assemble, it really is some of the best journalists in the world. That being said, the slow just deterioration of local journalism, particularly in sports, is problematic. It impacts everything from not only in terms of the knowledge that those in the community have about their athletes, but something as significantly fundamental as a kid getting recruited. It's really hard if you come from a very small neck of the woods to get recruited, even if you're really exceptional. You've got to take your talents on a grander scale at some point, and hopefully there's some national connection. But locally, you can't do that. I think back when I was in Syracuse, New York, and I worked at the Post Standard, I covered high schools. And I covered this one high school that was kind of small, but they had like six Division I prospects, which in itself was a story. And I remember writing about them all the time. And I wound up getting a job in North Carolina, which just so happened to be North Carolina State recruited two of those kids to play there. And I remember when they were handing out like their information packets of just about the kids, all my stories were in there. And so they knew about those kids, obviously, through the local press. And to me, that's what's starting to disappear. The finding that diamond in the rough for universities. Well, yeah, it's you have more tools to research and track athletes. It doesn't take the place of those well-placed feature stories introducing this sophomore who's 6'3", 210, who is going to be a big deal in 2 years.
So two things there. First, let's name that player from Brockton, A.J. DeBonsta, who's the number one
player in his age group. Yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing is, you know, we've got a local pastor, Reverend Laura Everett, who's been pushing better coverage of women's sports across the board, right? And really relying on local news outlets to try to work with her to get more of that covered. When those dimensions start to go away, we lose all that dialogue, right, as well. So I'll turn to you now, Shalice. There's some other pieces of the puzzle that are kind of unique to Boston, but affect the national scene. Mm-hmm. And I want to start to bring them in as we try to understand what's happening in the dissolution of local sports journalism and what it means for us, even especially those of us who love sports, but even those of us who don't necessarily pay attention to what's happening on the field every day or every week or every couple of days, right, depending. So I want to talk about Barstool Sports for just a second.
Now,
I'm glad you said, oh, goodness gracious, because we're not going to do all of the oh, goodness gracious, but I want our listeners to understand there's a book underneath the oh, goodness gracious, right? They are controversial for lots of different reasons. The piece that I want to bring up here, they're founded in Milton in 2003. The piece that I want to bring up here is they're often kind of created or credited in that cluster that popularizes sports content coming from fans instead of coming from journalists. So here's a little bit of founder Dave Portnoy. Again, yes, listeners, I understand, a very controversial figure, talking about the Patriots' Super Bowl chances during their eventual championship run in 2018.
The Saints can't score anymore. The Cowboys are a joke. The Bears, they play good defense, but Big Cat's fat. Still here.
Cheap shot.
Still here. The end of the dynasty? No. We tell you when it's over. We say when it's over. It's not even close. I'll see you in Atlanta. Still here.
Okay, that's a tone that actually feels kind of familiar in 2023. Might not have before the advent of an organization like that. What do you think is gained and lost? And Sherrod, I'm going to come back to you on this too, because I know you've done some thinking on this as well.
You know, I think you're losing, and it's not just fan-generated content. It's also team-owned media outlets. There's no pushback. You know, there's no... It's all supposed to be rainbows and unicorns and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, my former Boston Globe colleague, Dan Shaughnessy, used to write frequently about fans who would email him and be like, why don't you root for the Red Sox like we root for the Red Sox? That's not our job. You know, we are supposed to be objective. Yes, as human beings, when you're a beat reporter, especially, and you spend so much time around these teams, you may develop, you know, friendly relationships with certain players, and you do root for them quietly. But if they screw up, you still have to say, this person screwed up. You know, I had a tremendous relationship with Kevin Falk when I covered the New England Patriots. But that game when it was 4th and 2 and he didn't get those 2 yards in Indianapolis, I had to approach him after the game, to bring in an earlier point, and say, Kevin, we got to talk about this.
Yeah.
And to his everlasting credit, he said, give me 5 minutes. And then he talked about it. But we can't, you know, we're seeing it even now where there's a lot of reporting or reporters in this area speculating that Bill Belichick is on the hot seat. And there are fans, there are still fans who are in Bill we trust and Bill Belichick can do no wrong and, you know, just give him time. And we have to lay out for you as reporters what he's done wrong. And the fact that Bill Belichick, the GM, has hampered Bill Belichick, the coach, for years. But you can't fire one without firing both if it comes to that.
Because they are, in fact, the same
guy. The same person, yes. And so you need objectivity. You know, we've seen this rise of, like I said, every team in every professional sports league now has their own in-house media. I apologize, I keep bringing it back to the Patriots, but I spent a decade there. When Aaron Hernandez...
Then you should do that.
Yes. Yeah. When Aaron Hernandez was arrested, the Patriots in-house newspaper did like a paragraph. The Patriots cut Aaron Hernandez. He was arrested.
Okay, I'm going to pause you there. Aaron Hernandez, who later died, apparently died by suicide in prison after conviction in, I'm careful of the terms because I don't remember the legal term for which he was convicted, but in someone's death.
Yes. Yes. And so when he was arrested for that death, the Patriots released him. And the rest of us, the boss, I was at the Globe at the time and other news outlets, paragraphs and stories and headlines of what went wrong and did the Patriots know and da-da-da-da-da. And, you know, I know some of the guys who were at that in-house paper, they're good guys, but and I know this is just how it is, but it was just the Patriots released Aaron Hernandez on Wednesday. He was arrested on Wednesday. And that was it. And then they never really wrote about him again. So this is what we lose when we don't have... when we don't have objective sites. Like, I understand being a fan. I do. But you have to tell people what's really happening. You cannot put a glossy sheen on everything because it's just not.
And our team, thank you to the team just giving me the information, convicted of first degree murder. And I couldn't remember if it was first degree or not in 2015, sentenced to life.
And charged with 2 others eventually.
That's right. And we did earlier this year, we'll see if we can pull this to put it on the page, some conversations with 2 WBUR reporters who did some follow up on that and had been with the Globe and did reporting with the Globe on it as well. So we'll see if we can put some links to that. So Sherrod, let me just turn to you. I mean, so Elise has taken us deep into the kind of accountability that local people care about and the institutions that represent them and who they are. Right. Let's pick that thread up.
Yeah, it's One of the things I talk to my students a lot about is the importance of treating journalism kind of like a golf game, where you want to keep it on the fairway. One, that keeps you out of the rough. You're not trying to hit a hole in one every single time you go out and report a story. You want to keep it consistently on the fairway. One, it keeps you out of trouble. And two, it keeps people's interest. If all you're providing is a paragraph that says, he's no longer with our team, that's not going to keep people's interest. And so it's literally a disservice to news organizations to go into full fanboy girl mode, because it puts all of your potential investors, stakeholders in what you produce on one side of the conversation. And not everyone wants to be on that side. And as journalists, it's your job to keep it as balanced as possible, to give people a spectrum of sorts on issues and topics and things of that nature. So it's important that we understand the value of journalism and be able to discern between that and fans who are writing. And the thing that troubles me most is the way that we have kind of morph those two worlds together, those types of content creation together. I tell my students, because
it's part of the reason we brought you here, because you teach.
I flap my gums at my students all the time about lots of different stuff. But there is a distinction between being a journalist and being a content creator. Journalists hold themselves to a much higher standard than someone who's creating content. And sometimes creating content is part of being a journalist. In fact, it often is. But that in itself is not the standard that you measure yourself by. And unfortunately, we have a lot of people out there who generate lots of really engaging content that has no journalistic foundation whatsoever. You find a lot of the clickbaitish headlines where, so-and-so's thoughts on this, and you read it and it's like, he wanted to have a chicken sandwich instead of a ham sandwich when he went out to dinner with his wife. You're like, this is not news.
How does this affect my life?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so there's that.
I was just going to bring it to the absolute present, you know, as we talk about journalism versus fans or whatever. Later today, NFL owners will vote to approve a new team owner for the Washington Commanders, ending the 25-year calamity that was Dan Snyder as owner of the Washington NFL team. A big part of the reason that happened is because dozens of women stepped forward to the Washington Post and to the New York Times about the mistreatment, the sexual harassment, the endless number of, you know, awful things that they endured while working for Dan Snyder and the Washington football team, allegedly, I should say. But that's journalism. You know, and because of their bravery and because of the Washington Post digging and spending the time and the resources to pursue that story now over multiple years, this owner is gone.
Yeah.
You know, and not to say that the other 31 owners are saints, because if you pay attention to the NFL, you know that they are not. But Dan Snyder was a particularly problematic human being. And because of journalism, he's, you know, a big part of the reason is he's out now.
Well, I particularly appreciate the way the two of you have brought this home to the kind of accountability that we know as community we care about. Shalice Manza Young, columnist for Yahoo Sports, A. Sherrod Blakely, NBA writer and lecturer at Boston University School of Communications. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.